The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we have one of the authors of The Heart of Everything That Is. This is the untold story of Red Cloud, an American legend. Bob Drury is one of the authors. We have Tom Clavin in. Tom, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Why the book about Red Cloud?
This was kind of a happy accident. What I mean by that is Bob Drury and I had done three books together, all dealing with 20th century military history. We did Halsey's Typhoon about the Second World War. We did The Last Stand of Fox Company about a Marine Corps company in Korea. We did Last Men Out, which is about the last 11 Marines who were left on the roof of the American Embassy on the fall of Saigon. And the natural progression would have been, okay, what was left? You know, should we go into Afghanistan and Iraq? And we didn't want to go there. We thought, it seemed to us that it was being well covered by a lot of other people. And my co-author, Bob Drury, a foreign correspondent, had been to Iraq and Afghanistan several times. We thought about going backward in time. Can we find a story in American history that has not been told or has not been covered that much? And I had kept a folder aside. I said to Bob, I said, have you ever heard of the Fetterman Massacre? He said, no. I said, well, here's what happened. And he said, are there any books about it? And I said, well, there are some books. I mean, it's not like scholars have not addressed that. But I said, you know, it mentions that Red Cloud was the head of this group of 2,000 or so American Indians who attacked and wiped out Fetterman and his army contingent. And I've never heard of him before. And Bob said, I haven't either. Why don't we do a little bit of research? And that's how it came about. As we started to find out more about Red Cloud and his life and times, we realized, and I'm sort of an absolutist about this, I think that Red Cloud is the most significant American Indian figure of the 19th century in America. I you can argue for Sitting Bull and Cochise and Geronimo and Crazy Horse and the others, but Red Cloud's distinction, he's the only one to actually win a war against the U.S. government, and none of the others did.
In the book, The Heart of Everything That Is, you start off talking a little bit about Red Cloud. You look at the Indian nation as a whole, mm-hmm. with pretty much just close to every tribe, I guess, maybe in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. Well, Red Cloud, at the height of his power, I guess is a way to put it, let's say in the late 1850s, he and his affiliations, the Lakota Sioux and the affiliated tribes, they really controlled one-fifth of the United States. People were unaware at that time how much of the land was west of the Missouri River was still Indian land. And the most powerful of the Plains tribes was the Lakota Sioux and Red Cloud. And a big part of the book is the relationships between the tribes within the Sioux themselves, because you had, you know, Red Cloud was, his mother was Oglala, his father was Brule, Crazy Horse was Oglala, Sitting Bull was a Hunkpapa Sioux. So you had all these divisions within the Sioux. And then you had the relationships between the Sioux and the Pawnee and the Crow and the Arapaho and not the Apache so much, the Cheyenne. So a big part of the story is what life was like on the plains before the American Civil War, which is something that we had known so little about, especially because you don't have anybody, certainly from an Indian point of view, who were keeping diaries and journals, and that we have something called Red Cloud's autobiography, which is not quite what it is, but is absolutely a remarkable document that gives us insights and details that from an Indian point of view that doesn't exist otherwise.
The American government making treaties with the Indians, mm-hmm. they put forth a treaty. I don't know that the Indians really believed everything they were telling them because past treaties had been broken. The way your book kind of describes it is, even though the government was putting together treaties with the Indians, mm-hmm. that they were going to break them anyway, and the Americans knew it.
It was a series of tricks, of falsehoods, of deceptions. One of the things that basically when there was a tract of land that the U.S. government or elements of the U.S. government or private interests wanted, they would propose a treaty to the Indians. And there were so many things wrong with this. One is that the Indians did not have a concept that they owned the land in the first place. So to them, it was laughable that they were going to that this treaty would suddenly confer the rights to this land to the white people. And the other thing they did is that they would, the idea of chief was a white man concept. You know, it didn't come from the Indians. Indians didn't have a chief. But in order to have a treaty, you had to have somebody sign the treaty. And so basically they would, and there's several instances that we discuss this in the book, scenarios where, the army, for example, would, hey, you, okay, you're the chief. Okay, you come over here and sign this treaty. The other thing was they didn't sign treaties. They couldn't read or write, certainly not English. And so what they would do is they would have whoever was designated as a chief would touch the pen, meaning they would approach a guy, a functionary sitting at a desk, touch the top of the pen, the fountain pen, and that person would write a name down. Suddenly this treaty was valid. And the white people said, okay, we now have this treaty and we can take what we want that's in the treaty. The Indians thought the whole thing was ludicrous, you know, and they would be given some food or some guns or whatever, and they would go back to whatever they were doing. Well, what happened over and over and over again is when they would come back, let's say after the winter, to their usual hunting grounds and fishing grounds and places that they spent the springs, the summer, and the fall, they would be told, well, this isn't yours anymore, get out. And they said, what are you talking about? And the army would talk about these treaties, which was like, you know, a complete alien concept to the Indians. But it was a useful tactic. They just kept encroaching and intruding until, you know, what forced Red Cloud to go to war, because he was not intending to start a war against white people, but was they, when they got close to the Black Hills, that was for the Sioux, their most sacred land. And it was sort of like, the line in the sand was, or the line in the prairie was, don't go any further than this. And the army ignored that by going further than this and starting to build forts closer and closer to the Black Hills. And Red Cloud felt, I have no choice.
In your book, how much research did you do on the reservations and the parts of the nation that maybe the Sioux, the Lakota mm-hmm. owned? And talk a little bit about, if you would, the names, because Sioux, Lakota, mm-hmm. I mean, they're kind of interchangeable, aren't they, the Dakota Indians?
Well, the Sioux structure was that number 7 was very important to the Sioux, and they had 7 tribes. There was the Lakota Sioux, which was the more western-based Sioux. You had a Dakota Sioux, and only the D and the L are different, which was actually the way their language was. You know, one tribe had the D, the other one had the L. They were the ones that were mostly based in Minnesota, a little further east. So there were different elements of the Sioux, and sometimes they even fought among themselves. But it was sort of like the thing that, you know, it's like fighting among your brothers. You'll fight among your brothers, but if anybody from the outside tries to get nasty with one of your brothers, all the brothers band together. The research for me is something I really enjoy. I went on the road sort of following the trail of Red Cloud, and I would go to places like the South Dakota Historical Society, Nebraska State Historical Society, the Wyoming county, this county library in Sheridan, Wyoming, which would have these, they bring these things out in plexiglass, these old diaries and journals kept by teamsters and soldiers, officers' wives. And you had to put on white gloves and very delicately handle these original manuscripts to find out, you know, what life was like in the 1830s and 40s and 50s and 60s on the plains. And as I mentioned before, about from the Indian point of view, and I did go to the reservation, Pine Ridge Reservation, which eventually became the home of Red Cloud for the rest of his life. But there they don't have records because they were not writing about their experiences. That there is something called Red Cloud's autobiography is a very, very fortunate miracle, basically, that there is such a document. But mostly it was getting the point of view of people who would day after day get a few more miles west on their way to Montana, on their way to Wyoming, and record their encounters with the Indians, and family matters, and weather events on their way west. And that was fascinating, and that's what I think, what I hope makes the book authentic, because we didn't put anything in there that's just conjecture. Oh, this sounds good. I saw it in a John Ford movie. No, this is, if it's in there, it's because we have source material for it.
The reservation, talk to me about that. What is that like? A bustling metropolis?
I think Red Cloud's War ended supposedly in 1868 when he did sign a treaty that supposedly protected the Black Hills. But Red Cloud's War, to me, never ended. And the most glaring example of the collateral damage of that war is the Pine Ridge Reservation. There are some wonderful, courageous, hardworking people who live there, but they're in the minority in the sense that you have 80% unemployment rate. I'm not making this up. You go to the Oglala Sioux website. This information is there. 80% unemployment rate. The average life expectancy of a Oglala male is 49 years old. Very high rates of diabetes, hypertension, alcoholism. It's a dry reservation, but you just go across the border to Nebraska and you can get all the liquor you want. So it's to me, it's a situation where we went in there, the U.S. government, the U.S. Army went in there to basically eradicate, captivate the Indians so we could have all that land and fulfill our manifest destiny. And then what happened is, okay, well, we broke it, so we own it. And what you have, Pine Ridge Reservation is also an example of the dependence on the federal government. Because, with such high unemployment, a lot of these people survive only because of benefits given them by the federal government. So it's a bustling metropolis. I think that ship, whatever it ever existed, sailed a long time ago.
Yes, it's kind of sad because from White Clay, Nebraska, you see just carload to carload of Native Americans going into maybe about two or three liquor stores. And I think that's about all that consists in that town.
Yeah.
And it is one of the largest places of alcohol sales, I think, in all the nation.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to isolate just one company, but I know that the tribes sued earlier this year Anheuser-Busch, because obviously for Anheuser-Busch, they want to just keep pumping their products there and undercutting, lowering the price to make it even more enticing to keep buying. But what it's doing is it's destroying a large part of the tribe with the rates of alcoholism and related diseases.
In your book, Tom, we see a lot of Indian words in this. Mm-hmm. Did you do interviews with the people to learn this? How did you come up with those?
Well, two ways. One is to, yes, talk to members of the Oglala Sioux tribe and descendants of Red Cloud to talk about their language. In fact, one of the crises that the tribe is facing is that the Lakota language is fading, is an endangered species. Efforts are underway to try and teach the language to a younger generation, but it's a fairly familiar and unfortunate scenario that older members of the tribe who still speak it, or some of it at least anyway, as they die off, they're not being replaced by the same number of people who know the language. But also there one of the things that helped us is that there were academics and others who spent a lot of time in the 1800s and into the 1900s with members of the tribe, recording their recollections and oral histories and trying to get the spellings right. Now, some of them are probably not all correct, or I'm sure there's words where people disagree on what the correct, we found it, different spellings, but we tried to, as much as possible, give the Indian name for things we were talking about. This is not an academic book. It is the heart of everything that is designed for the general reader. And it's, I think, a rip-roaring yarn, a good story, but why not get people more informed at the same time too? Because there's so much that we don't know about the Plains Indians and that whole part of history of the 1840s right up through the Civil War.
Red Cloud, born in the panhandle of Nebraska. Whereabouts was he actually born?
Well, there's certainly nothing to this day that says, Red Cloud born here. It was on the Platte River in Nebraska. That's as much as we know, because, again, there was no such thing as a tribal historian. You know, you could have these ships in the, you know, in the 1500s that were making their way across the ocean to come discover America, so to speak. And you had the captain would keep a diary, and you may even have a ship historian, and you may have a fairly educated first mate who might be making his notes. But so much of what the Indians were doing, any genealogies, you know, were not recorded anyplace. You know, there's nothing like the Mormons have, for example. Supposedly in Salt Lake City, they have these enormous, vast repositories of genealogies, and it's really an unfortunate thing that the American Indians don't have that. Certainly, past a certain point backward in history, the little bit that we have is usually because there were European explorers or missionaries who were, you know, among the Indian peoples and writing down some of their thoughts. But that's about as close as we get.
Fort Robinson, Fort Laramie, I'm sure you visited those sites.
What my favorite fort to visit was Fort Phil Kearny, because that's one of the forts that Red Cloud burned to the ground. When they offered him a treaty to stop the Red Cloud's war, he said, well, first thing is you have to abandon these forts that you built along the Bozeman Trail that threatened the Black Hills. And when the army did, as they abandoned each one, he and his warriors would come down the hill and torch it and burn it to the ground. And going up to Fort Phil Kearny, which was the biggest one and the one that stuck in Red Cloud's craw the most, they actually have the outline of the fort. You could walk the fort where the different rooms were and the guided. It's up in Sheridan, outside Sheridan, Wyoming. And I love to go to places like that and talk to the park rangers. These people are wonderful. If any park rangers are listening, you know, you make my life a lot better, because it's not just a job to these people, or most of them anyway. They really research and want to know what's about this fort that I should know, because people are going to ask me questions and I want to know as much as I can. So you get these wonderfully knowledgeable people who have such great patience, and you ask them a question, they'll just go ahead and tell you a great story. And so much information comes from them because they themselves have done the research and they've made the attempt to be authentic. They're not just repeating stories that may or may not be true.
So the fort burned down. They haven't rebuild any of it, or have they?
No, the only thing they've done is they created like with wood planks, an outline of where the different set, you know, here's where the colonel's quarters were, here's where the magazine was, the ammunition was kept, here's where the sutler's store was, you know, here's where the officers' quarters were. And so you could actually walk from room to room, but there are no walls. You know, there's no roof, there's no walls, and there's no anything. And there's sketches, of course, of the original fort after it was built, which was Colonel Henry Carrington was the guy in charge who built it. And it was just this amazing fort. And it's kind of too bad it doesn't exist anymore, because it was like a state-of-the-art fort for 1866. But that was Red Cloud wanted to make sure that because to him it was a symbol of the ultimate intrusion. And when that was burned down and the other forts he burned down, then he came in and said, okay, I'll sign your treaty now because there's no forts left.
I know at Fort Laramie they have reconstructed some of that. Mm-hmm. Some of the old jail and stuff you can still see.
Right.
At one point in your book, The Heart of Everything That Is, they had pretty much a big powwow around that United States invited them to.
If only video was around in those days. It must have been amazing, because in 1851 there was this powwow, convention, pageant, and they sent a word out to all the tribes in the surrounding area, you know, come on in, we want to talk about a peace treaty where we can do our thing and you can do your thing and we'll protect your hunting grounds. And it all sounded very good at the time. And something like 10,000 Indians of all the different tribes, the Sioux, the Shoshone, the Crow, the Pawnee, Cheyenne, they all sent their headmen and families and the braves and everything else. And they all descended on Fort Laramie for this unprecedented gathering of Indians. It had never been that large number before, and of different tribes, as early as a month earlier, might have been at war with each other. So, Fort Laramie was really the most important fort, I guess you would say, west of the Missouri for many, many years. And it was a gathering place and trading post for the whites, the Europeans, the Indians it was like in a gathering place, especially in the wintertime, if they ran out of food, they would come to Fort Laramie.
How about some of the other forts along that Oregon Would they call it the Mormon Trail at that time or not?
There was the Oregon Trail, Bozeman Trail. There was the Mormon Trail. They were all these trails were being established as they were pushing further and further west. The Bozeman Trail was the one that went up to Silver City, Montana, where there was gold. And that's, you know, gold was what drove a lot of these, this fort building, because you'd have these migrants and these explorers, coming out there because they wanted to get gold. And as there were more and more of them, they started to build forts because they'd have places to rest and feed their horses, get some sleep, trade for some other goods. And soon after they build a fort, then the army would have to protect those forts because they would be concerned about Indian reprisals for building on Indian land. So it was a process of going a little further west and north and building a fort, and the army were coming in and repeating that process over and over again. So Fort Laramie was very big, Fort Phil Kearny, Fort C.F. Smith was one of the outposts. There was eventually a Fort Bridger named for the mountain man, Jim Bridger. That's one of the parts in the book I like the most, is talking about Jim Bridger and Kit Carson and these other mountain men, because they did not keep diaries necessarily themselves, but their adventures would be recorded by other people. And so that's how we know some of what was going on in the 1820s and 1830s and those very first interactions between Europeans and Indians in the plains.
So with this book, how did you write this with Bob? I mean, are you too close enough where you can collaborate in person? Did you do it over the internet phone?
Well, Bob and I have been friends for many, many years. We go back to our newspaper days, working for different newspapers, and then we became friends, and we're very, very good friends. Even though this is our fourth book together, we've survived. Our friendship has survived. But the way we usually divide things is I'm more of the research person, and I try and get all the material together and organized, and then I hand it in sections to Bob, who does the writing. We realized early on, our very first collaboration, Halsey's Typhoon, you cannot have four hands at the keyboard. You have to speak in one voice. So I do the majority of the research work, he does the majority of the writing, and then he comes back to me for editing. And that's the way we collaborate. And it's been, I have to say, knock wood, a smooth collaboration to produce four books of fairly lengthy and imposing subjects.
Tell me about your newspaper, The Past Days Gone By.
I worked for a bunch of newspapers and weekly newspapers, and my big break was getting to write for the New York Times, which I did for 15 years, and that opened up other doors for me to work for magazines. And one of the ways that I got into book writing was that being a newspaper man is you'd find people who had wonderful stories to tell but were not writers. And so you would say, well, you would collaborate with somebody else. I remember collaborating on a book called Fatal Analysis with a psychologist who found out in his practice that one of his clients was a serial killer, and how was he going to deal with that and this kind of stuff. And it was a wonderful story, but he was never going to write it by himself. So we collaborated, and that got my foot in the door to writing books. So it's just funny the way it's worked out, because I'm either doing a book with Bob that's related to military history, or I do quite a bit in the world of sports. My last book was a book called The DiMaggio's, which is about all three brothers who made it to the major leagues. So I have the great good fortune to be able to go back and forth between the two. I'll book to a book of my own that's usually sports related. I'll do a book with Bob that's of some untold story of American history that's so fascinating to us. And so it's been a worthy endeavor to come up with these stories that we mostly think people have not read about before.
What are your ideas on the demise, pretty much, of a lot of newspapers? I mean, newspapers across the country have, a lot of them have folded up. Some have gone even 3 days a week. Mm-hmm. A lot smaller newspapers. What's your thought on that?
I don't think it's going to change. I don't think there's any magic potion that's going to save the newspaper industry. I think they're smart. Those are the ones that are putting resources into web editions of the website versions, because what we're seeing is it's not the newspaper people themselves that are saying, oh, let's commit suicide here and close the paper. It's just that their audience is getting their information from different sources. You know, I also teach at the college level. I do a couple of writing courses every semester. And so I'm dealing with people who are anywhere from 18 to 24 years old. And they're not reading newspapers. It hurts me to say this because I love newspapers. I've always still feel like I have ink in my veins, but all their information comes from handheld devices and from social media. And that's when they get to be in 30s and 40s and 50s. Who knows what their children will be getting information from. But in the foreseeable future, content has got to be directed towards these devices that they're downloading. And same thing with books. The Heart of Everything, that is, if this was published 10 years from now, it might only be in electronic form.
The Heart of Everything, that is, when you get somebody that reads this book, what do you expect them to leave with? What kind of feeling?
I guess two things. One is to feel like, my goodness, I never knew about such an imposing and amazing figure as Red Cloud. How did that skip by me in social studies class and my interest in American history? I think the other thing is I hope that they'll be intrigued enough that they will try and find out more about the present-day state of American Indians. There continue to be so many promises made to them that either later get ignored or just blatantly broken. And that's something in our society that it's the elephant in the room, I think, that we just keep ignoring.
Well, the book is The Heart of Everything That Is, This the Untold Story of Red Cloud, An American Legend by Bob Drury and Tom Clavin. This book, I tell you what, when you dig into it, when you start reading that, these guys are going to bring this story to life. You're going to be on the plains. You're going to be among the Indians. You're going to, actually, they'll take you to the forts, Fort Phil Kearny, mm-hmm. Fort Laramie. And you know what? There was a part that I thought, I didn't realize they didn't have ponies at one time. And, you know, how much in the Stone Age were these Indians before the white man came? You'll find out all that and more in the book, The Heart of Everything That Is, The Untold Story of Red Cloud, An American Legend by Bob Drury and Tom Clavin. Tom, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad to be here and talk about Red Cloud.
Been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.